nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, one part that probably many people asked me about, so let me say a few words about it. And that is has to do with this second quantization. That what's this? What does that mean? And I guess that's related to what you asked also. So you see, the thing you hear a lot is that how electrons, photons, all of these are both particles and waves. And so in the particle picture, when you think of electrons or photons as particles, then you have an energy-momentum relationship usually. That's how a particle has a certain relationship between energy and momentum, which could, say, look something like this. Or if you are talking of the photons, then it may look something like E is equal to C times B, for example, etc. So when you think of as a particle, there's an EP relationship. And then comes the wave picture, where you turn this into a differential equation. That's the wave equation that you have. And corresponding to this, there is this Schrodinger equation. Right? So, that's a wave equation. And corresponding to this again, I guess you'll have Maxwell's equation, basically. So for Maxwell's equation, one form of it would be second derivative of E with respect to time is like C squared times second derivative of, and by this E, I mean electric field. Actually, I didn't write the C correctly. So in the simplest form, it would be something like this. And you could say, well, if you start from this, then you could, just as here, the energy-momentum relationship gave you a wave equation by replacing E with IH bar ddt and P with d2 dx2. Same, you could say, this became that. Thank you. Yeah, almost proof that C equals 1, I guess. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So, now, one way of interpreting the electric field of a photon is something like the wave function of the photon. I mean, that's not how Maxwell wrote it down, of course. And Maxwell's time, no one was thinking of, as a wave function in that case. But you could view this as the wave function of single photons. So, for example, the way you learn Maxwell's equations usually is that if you have two media, let's say this is glass and this is air. And we calculate that, well, if you have a steady stream of light coming in, 1 watt, and let's say half gets reflected and another half gets transmitted, or whatever it is, you can calculate, knowing the dielectric constant, there'll be some reflection, some transmission, etc. Now, and this is, of course, intended for a large beam of light, lots of energy that's incident. Now, what if you cut this down so that you are down at a single photon level? One photon comes in, and then something gets reflected, something gets transmitted. So, point is, it's not that half a photon will get reflected or half a photon will get transmitted. The way you are supposed to interpret it is that the photon has half a chance of getting reflected and half a chance of getting transmitted. But whatever happens, it will either be transmitted or reflected. It won't break up. That's the point. So, as soon as you go to that level, that's when the probabilistic interpretation comes in. Right? And that, of course, in the beginning was a major philosophical jump for people to accept, because the assumption always was that when there's no stochastic things involved, when I know everything, I should be able to predict what a photon should do. And the point is, what this tells you is, you know everything about the light that came in, that photon that was coming in, but there's no way you can predict whether it will be transmitted or reflected. All you can say is that if you do the experiment 100 times, half the times it will be transmitted, half the times it will be reflected. Okay? So even with light, you have that basic thing always, you see. And so one way of interpreting Maxwell's equations then is as if this E is like the wave function of the photon. That would be one way of thinking about it. As I said, Maxwell didn't intend it that way. Okay. And with electrons, say that's the way you think of psi usually. That's supposed to give you the probability of things. Now, the reason this is somewhat different from this is because of course everyone realizes that, you know, electric fields are rather real in the sense you can measure them. Wave functions, you can't really measure them. And why is that? Well, in Feynman lectures, I think Feynman says at some point that, well, the difference is that because these electrons, these being Fermi particles, usually whenever you have, so let me draw this EK relationship. So for electrons, let's say we have this E versus P. So the point is that in a given state here, you can either put one electron in there or not have any electrons in there, zero or one. So for every state, you can either have zero or no particles. But you cannot put two electrons into it because of the exclusion principle. On the other hand, when you look at light, and you plot omega P relationships, it's like this, and you take any of any particular frequency mode, any mode there, you could put any number of photons into it, millions of them. Right? And so it is as if you have a whole series, it could go 0, 1, 2, everything's possible. That's the difference. And Feynman makes the point that, you know, when you have lots of them, then you can, when you can put so many of them into a mode, they can also add up coherently to give you a huge electric field. That's actually measurable, which never happens with the electrons. That's the way he put it. And that's why, finally, when it comes to electrons, it's only the psi star psi that's measurable. And of course, this he says in the context of trying to explain superconductivity, where he says that, well, the superconductor is one case where electrons form Cooper pairs and then act like bosons, so a lot of them add up in a way to give you a coherent wave function whose phase is actually measurable. But that's a whole different thing. But in this context, then, the point I'm trying to make is this step to this step, that's what usually you refer to as first quantization. And then from here, there is this next step which has both wave and particle properties. And that's that second quantization. So the idea is, from this, you get a EK relationship. And then the idea is that for every one of these, it's like two states there. Possibly there's a zero and a... You could either occupy this state or not occupy this state. And so that entire, when you're using this picture, I mean, at this level, of course you have to work with, these states and do the quantum mechanics of these states. Right? I mean, that's the part where, that's the second quantization, right? Which allows you to handle things. And this is what we normally are not doing. What we're normally doing is thinking of it in one particle terms, trying to figure out what one electron does. And then doing averages properly. This is the point I tried to make earlier, that do you add wave functions or do you add psi star psi, etc. Right? Now, one point that often comes up, again, these are the questions that people ask me, is that, okay, this NEGF that I described to you, doesn't this include all kinds of many electron interactions, for example, right? And this is where I guess the answer has many aspects to it. So let me explain a little bit. I guess Dr. Raja, he talked a little bit about this, the general NEGF formalism, that how it actually, the way you define this Gn, you know, I wrote it here as just psi star. I said that, well, you know, take one electron wave functions, add up the psi stars. The more formal way of defining it would be the expectation value of certain second quantized operators, etc., which is actually working in this picture, you know, which has both wave and particle picture all built into it. It's actually working in that picture. Anyway, so originally when this formalism was developed, that's back in the 60s by Schwinger, Kadanoff, and Baim, and Keldysh, of course, yeah. So there's number of people who actually used, developed different parts differently, and I guess in the beginning I used to call it the Keldysh, Kadanoff, Baim formalism, and then I got letters from some of Schwinger's students who were very unhappy that I had left out Schwinger's name, and then I decided that, you know, I'm better off calling it something neutral like non-equilibrium green functions. You see, because there are so many people involved at different ways. And I guess Baim was one of Schwinger's students, actually, right? Yes. Anyway, so that's this general non-equilibrium green function theory. And broadly, of course, as Dr. Raja pointed out, that while equilibrium statistical mechanics is very well established, non-equilibrium problems don't quite have such well-defined methods yet, by and large. See? And so this important thing here is the non-equilibrium green function. So if you look at those equations up there, the first equation up there, that's what you'd see in equilibrium green function theory also. G equals E minus H minus sigma inverse. That's the one that you wouldn't see there is, let's say, this third equation, the Gn equals G gamma, G dagger, etc. You see, that's got these two Fermi functions in it, for example, what I wrote. Yeah. And this is the equation that first appeared in, let's say, Keldysh's paper. Keldysh's 1965 paper, there was an equation that, by the way, the notation I use is a little different from what's in the literature. So, I think, way I would write it is G, then all these things, gamma 1, F1, plus gamma 2, F2, etc. Plus, I think I had a sigma N, right here. So that's the equation. That's this third equation I had there. And of course, back in the 60s when Keldysh, Kadanoff, Baim were developing this, no one thought about contacts. So of course, they didn't have this. It is really all about that. Because as I said, when you're dealing with big conductors, the entire physics of conduction is in those interactions. That's the important thing, right? And so it was this one. And the notation you'll see in the literature usually is, it's not Gn, they write it as G less. So that's the thing you'll see in Keldysh's paper. And the connection between these two is just that what I write as Gn is actually minus I G less. That's all. And same here. This is this minus I times this. Now, why do I use this? Well, because this one, when you look at its diagonal elements, it gives you the electron density. So it has a very clear meaning, physical. Right? Whereas this one was motivated by, I think the name was this contour ordered theory. So this less tells you what order you take a certain complex integral in the what order of times you use when evaluating a certain integral, you see. So that's where that less came from. And so it wasn't quite, so when you look at this one, it's like the diagonal elements are not quite the electron density. You have to multiply by minus I and all that. So this is why I adopted this notation. Because when I was doing this, of course, I was trying to get all these, I obtained all these results like I described to you this morning, straight from the one electron Schrodinger equation. Because, you see, when it comes to those terms that involves the contacts, that F1 and F2, those first two terms, you don't really need many-body perturbation theory to get those. That part, we can do exactly what I did in the morning. You could do it a little better than that. That's what's in my books. You can look. So the part where you might need many-body perturbation theory would be to figure out how to write that down in a systematic way for all kinds of interactions to different degrees of, you know, different terms in the perturbation series. That's the part where you might need it. And even there, if you were talking about the elastic resistor, where all the interactions are elastic, then you can almost write it intuitively. You don't really need it. The real power of this is it allows you to handle much more complex interactions up to any order you want, any degree of approximation, etc. And of course, because in those days, of course, this wasn't even there, this was the all-important thing. And so that is why, because of the history of the subject, a lot of the literature is always based on many-body perturbation theory. What that means, of course, is that if you do not know that, you cannot quite even get started there, right? Now, my other question that comes up here is that strong interactions, as Dr. Raja pointed out, your strong interaction, the strongly correlated systems, that, of course, is a frontier subject in here. We know where there is a lot that is not understood. There are a lot of interesting results. And one question I often have from people is whether NEGF, since it's a many-body method, I mean, people think of it, that should actually include interactions to any order you want. That's the feeling, you see. But what I've always felt, and what I have discovered looking at different problems gradually, is that that's not really true. And I can give you a simple example of that, actually. And the reason I believe is that the way this, you see, the way these terms are calculated, that's those contacts, those are actually exact. It's not a perturbation expansion or anything. That's exact. I mean, whatever I did today, we could take a little more time and do it properly, but that's all exact. There's no approximations there. But anytime it comes to interactions, whatever you do is approximate. And you can do it, and usually, for most calculations, you usually stop at the Born approximation, but you could go beyond that. You know, like Kondo effect that he mentioned actually leads a third order term. I mean, the third order perturbation. Yes. Yes, please.
So, are they taken into account when you count at Hartree level, when you count the sound consistently with some oscillating wave and something like that? So, in some level, you're
doing a mean view. Right. So, I'd say, you know, whatever you're doing here, one thing that you should include, of course, in the age is the potential from the Poisson equation, right? And that is basically is the Hartree term. And as I say, people make corrections to that one. They include correlation and exchange and correlation corrections to that because the actual potential is always a little less. But then there are things that this won't really cover. And the simplest way I often point this out is by saying that, you know, perturbation expansion amounts to doing this. I mean, in various forms, it amounts to doing something like this. And usually you say, okay, if you are not happy with x, we'll go to x square. If you're not happy with x square, we'll go to x cube. Good. But does that work when x is equal to 2? Not really. That's, it really doesn't matter how many orders you have gone up. Really doesn't get you there. Right? That's the point. And there are examples which are kind of in that category. And in the context of transport, I felt that, for example, Coulomb blockade, that's an example which ordinarily you might think that, well, you could just take NEGF and treat the electron-electron interactions a little better. Don't just stop at Hartree. Let's put in a few more things. But you still won't get all the right features of Coulomb blockade. You know, you might be able to manage to get certain things, but you won't get a lot of other things. And those are things I have often mentioned in different contexts. So, for example, one of the examples we discussed was that if you had one level, say, and you connected it to a contact, so let's say the mu is right. The chemical potential is right there. and you can put a small voltage across it. And question is, will it conduct? Right? And usually you'd have said that, well, you know, I've connected it to the context. Let's say it's broadened out something like this. And as I said, always upspin and downspin are degenerate. So you usually have two levels. So you usually have these two levels here. And you could calculate the potential self-consistently from Hartree and all that. And let's say you try to calculate what the conductance is. And if you have, say, one electron inside here, then you'd think that the Fermi level is somewhere here. It's half filled. And you got two levels, half filled, so basically one electron. Now, the thing is that if the interaction is strong enough, it won't stay that way. What will happen is one of these levels will sink down and one of these levels will float up. So instead of both of them upspin and downspin, both being right there and thereby giving you a lot of density of states to conduct, what will happen is, yeah, one will go down, one will go up, and so you actually won't conduct very well. Now, why is that? The simplest way people think about it is, they say, well, you know, there is this self-interaction correction. That is, the idea is that no electron feels any potential due to itself. So what happens is, let's say this, the way I have drawn this has one electron in it. And because you have one electron in it, what has happened is the other level has floated way up. Why? Because it feels a potential due to that. You know, you have to include this potential due to this one. So it has floated up by what's called the single electron charging energy. But you say, well, but then why didn't this one float up? Well, because it doesn't feel anything due to itself. That's all. It only feels something due to that one, but then that one's way up there, it's empty. There's nothing in there anyway. You see? So if you had included this point in your thinking, that no level feels anything due to itself, but only feels something due to all the other ones, then the solution you'd have come to would not have looked like this, where both levels were degenerate. You know, up and down in the absence of magnetic field are supposed to be degenerate. So you wouldn't have come to this situation where it is degenerate, but which one goes down and one goes up. And to me, this would be a bottom-up view of the Mach transition, essentially. You see, the Mach transition that Dr. Raja talked about, this would be my bottom-up view of the Mach transition, the simplest Mach transition in a way.
But why did it come down and didn't get there?
Right. So what I'm saying is, what I said was that let's say it is down. What I'm trying to say is that that is a self-consistent situation. What could happen is it could have gone the other way also. Yeah. Yes, please feel free to, you know, speak up. Yeah, please join.
Another way to understand why it has to be down. So let me consider an atomic level body of just one side with a certain orbital energy and a certain interaction mu. Okay. And I'll write it in the following form: epsilon d n d sigma plus u n d up n d down. So this is just one level which is decoupled from the leaves completely. This model can be exactly solved. Okay. In the site basis, there are only four states which are allowed. One is zero occupied state, one is up, down, and the fourth one is up, down. That has two electrons, single electron and zero electron. Okay. Now you want to enforce one electron occupancy on this state, right? Now since you know all the states, you also know all the energies of this, because you can just take this Hamiltonian and apply it to this, operate on this. You'll get an energy zero here, you'll get an energy epsilon d, again epsilon d, and 2 epsilon d plus u. Correct? Now what you can do is, you can find the partition function exactly with this, and then find out what is the average occupancy n. Right? Now if you enforce that sum over n sigma equal to 1, what you will get is this, epsilon d equal to minus u by 2. Okay? If u is large, which is what the case we are considering here,
then epsilon d will be very much below the Fermi energy. That is the case we are considering.
Sorry, the capital D is the energy?
Orbital. The level, the energy level.
But isn't there an overall offset that you can add or subtract?
There is no offset here.
I mean, so what is zero?
See, zero is the Fermi level. So we are measuring everything with respect to the Fermi level.
So this is a question whether, so it is almost like if I have my chemical, it's an open system. So you could say, well, if I have my mu somewhere, what is the N? That's one way of thinking. But the other way is if you say that the N is fixed, then question is, what should it look like? And then it is kind of forced to float down because one needs to be filled, right? You need to have one electron in there.
And zero energy, so if you put your epsilon d equal to minus u by 2, right, then this is energy 0, this is 0, and these two are beta. So the transitions between the singly occupied state and the zero occupied state are equally probable as compared to the singly occupied state and the doubly occupied state. So on an average, the negative fluctuations of the occupation number are equal to the positive fluctuations of the occupation number. So the average occupancy is 1.
So this is a regime that you see in the beginning. Yes, please.
You can also come from like a crystal structure, like the inversion asymmetry.
Yeah, but those would all be one electron arguments, though, isn't it? That probably wouldn't help. Here the point I'm trying to make is that when you have strong interactions, so that this one electron charging energy is large, and we can talk about in a minute how large it needs to be. Then a simple Poisson equation would give you wrong things. Or even if you corrected it, you wouldn't get the right things. But one way you can get almost the right things is if you enforce this self-interaction correction. If you kind of build into this thought that one only feels the potential due to the other. Except that that's really not a general solution. But if you do a Google search on self-interaction correction, you'll find, hundreds of papers. People who have tried, who have many different schemes how to use this correction. And these are all could be corrections to the, because what you'd really like to do is not go to a second quantized picture because that is harder to do in a bigger system especially. You'd like to have this one electron picture. The idea that one electron sees some potential due to all the rest. Right? That's what this U is supposed to be. What average potential it feels due to other things. And question is, can you get the right physics within that picture? I mean, to the extent it works, you call it a mean field theory. That's what the mean field is. It's the mean field due to all the other electrons. And at the least, what you need to do is have this self-interaction correction in that mean field. But even that won't get you everything. And one of the things I've discovered is some things that actually work for equilibrium problems, where it's kind of close to equilibrium, won't really work when you put a bigger bias and try to do non-equilibrium problems. So for example, when you look at the current versus voltage. With one level, I had said earlier how it steps up like this. We discussed this, that if you had a mu here and you pulled it down, at some point you'd have a volt current through this. Well, if you have two levels, what do you get? That's the question. Now, with two levels, you'd think, well, it would just be double of that. Well, but because of this Coulomb blockade effect, if you're really in this regime when U0 is large, the point is you'll actually see two steps. And now the fact that you get two steps, you can get it by putting in this self-interaction correction, that you one doesn't feel the other. What you won't get with that, though, is the steps are not equal. This is two-thirds and that's one-third. That won't come out of that simple picture at all. So this is an example where something when you're close to equilibrium might work quite well, but when it's a non-equilibrium effect, you may not get it at all. You see, etc. Because, as you know, one of the very powerful theories in terms of handling many body interactions, this correction is the DFT, which has worked very well and widely used. But most of the applications have been to equilibrium problems. You know, where you're talking about the equilibrium structure and all that. But basically, of course, it tells you how to correct the Hartree potential so as to include a lot of these many body effects and does it very well. But it close to equilibrium works very well. But out of equilibrium, so whenever I talk to many of the people working in molecular electronics and they tell me, you know, we have this version of DFT which works. And I tell them, well, can you get this 2/3 and 1/3 thing out of it? He said, oh, sure, we'll do that. Next time I meet, have you done it? Not really. I can't. So I've never seen a actual mean field treatment that will get you that 2/3 and 1/3. You see? Yeah, well, because we are still calculating steady state, so I think you don't really need the time dependent. You know, this is an interesting point that these Green's functions, you know, are like r prime t t prime. And this t t prime is t, you can always transform it to t minus t prime and t plus t prime over 2. And time dependent DFT, of course, is working with that one. But I think you need more, some self-energy that's energy dependent, which is this part. So GW or you think things like that. Anyway, that's a whole different story. But the main point I wanted to, I thought, you know, this is something I should mention. And because what I feel is that NEGF, you know, works very well as long as this mean field picture works. And so the question you ask is, when does the mean field picture work? So in things like this, the basic point is that this single electron charging energy, that means here I have a channel. When I put one electron in, how much does its potential change? Now, if it's a very big conductor, then of course one electron changes things by a microvolt. Who cares? Really doesn't matter. But when you have something really small, then adding one electron makes an enormous difference. Right? And the smaller it gets, the more important it is. And so for example, if you are talking about a hydrogen atom, you know, one thing we all know is a hydrogen atom has these two 1s levels, which is, this is the vacuum level. This is like minus 13.6 electron volt. And there's an electron in there. Now, and you draw these two levels. So it looks like there is a level empty where you could put an electron in. Not really. If you actually try to put an electron into a hydrogen atom, that energy is somewhere here, way up there. Because the single electron charging energy is like 10 volts. On something as small as a hydrogen atom, one electron, that will be 10 volts. You see? So the smaller it gets, of course, this U0 gets bigger and bigger. So as long as it is much less than KT, you're fine. You're fine meaning you're okay using our standard theories, which is why a lot of the Coulomb blockade effects in small conductors were first observed at 4 Kelvin, 10 Kelvin, low temperatures. You know, you have to go to low temperatures to see it. Even now, lots of times, that's where you see all that. But there's a second thing, and that is that let's say it's bigger than KT, so that this one is not satisfied. There is a second thing that also helps the mean field picture, and that is the gamma. Because the point is, as I said, as soon as you connect it to contacts, these things broaden out. So, and what you can see is, of course, is that if that broadening were bigger than U0, then you wouldn't even have noticed all this. You'd be fine. Right?
One remark in that respect is, so this is very close to the interacting resonant level model, where if you look at it in terms of the Condor effect, then the Condor scale goes as e to the power minus u by gamma. If gamma is very large, then u by gamma will be small, and then the pK would not really matter. So
on that context.
The temperature
absolutely
effect would really wash out the Condor.
Agreed. Absolutely. Yes. So the point I make here is, so the limit we are usually like to operate in, where you can safely use any GF without any special issues, is when U is less than or of order gamma. Gamma being this connection to contacts, how easily electrons flow.
Yeah, even in the absence of any self-interaction, if like the bias which I apply is very large, so in that case also you cannot take it as a small perturbation. So the perturbation theory should not hold in that case also.
Yeah, except that the way we are doing it, I do not view that the bias is being treated as a perturbation though in any of this.
In the Hamiltonian, when you are adding the potential, so...
Right, but what drives things, this is the point I try to make, what I like about the non-equilibrium method is, you're really driving it with those Fermi functions, the F1, F2. That's where you are feeding in electrons, etc. And the electric field just goes in the Hamiltonian as is. I mean, you're not, there's no perturbation theory about it. So, if it's a big field, yeah, you can include that. The main, in practice, you could worry about whether the model Hamiltonian you're using, whether that is, those are often limited in validity in terms of their energy scale. You know, you use some EK relation that works over this range of energies. And if you are injecting electrons all over.
Right.
So, that's a limitation from the Hamiltonian point of view.
If we correct on that, you can.
You should be. That would be my feeling. It is this electron-electron interaction that turns it into an unmanageable problem. I mean, that's the central unsolved problem in all of condensed matter, really. That there's almost hardly any exact solutions to anything.
In fact, just an inference, the strong coupling problem is a bottleneck in many other fields now. In gauge theory, in quantum thermodynamics, the strong coupling problem is
a universal problem. Right. At every stage, that is almost like the frontier thing. And the high TC superconductor, you know, it was... It's like now, what, 20 years old? More than that, right? In 1986. 86, right. Okay. So we're talking 24 years. And still no solution really, right?
And also, how do we calculate the coherence length? Like, is it the same as the de Broglie length? Like, when you can say, like, if the length of the conductor is of the order of such a length, you have to go to NEGF, otherwise you can use, like,
N+. Okay. Let me come to that. Right. Okay. So, and this one, as you can see, kind of brings in this particle aspect into it. So, as long, without this, it is almost like electrons are behaving like waves, you see. And as I said, as long as you are looking at just the average flow, you know, the point I made earlier, that usually, like if you have air and glass and you have light coming in, 1 watt comes in, 0.5 watt goes back, and 0.5 watt goes through. Question is, do I need to worry about the quantum nature of photons to calculate this? And I say that, well, as long as you're trying to figure out the steady state flow of things, you can just use Maxwell's equations, you're fine. The point where you start worrying about the particle nature of the photon is when you worry about noise, for example. So if you really cut this down to one photon, then of course it's probabilistic. One photon comes in, there's half a chance it will be reflected, half a chance it will be transmitted. And in practice, of course, it will either be transmitted or reflected. Not that half will go one way or the other. And that would then, you'd have to, if you wanted to calculate the noise associated with all that, then you have to take the particle nature into account. Right? And in the beginning, what Dr. Raja was talking about involved the noise due to electrons. He talks about shot noise, etc. And there, of course, again, you have the exact same issue, that when an electron goes through, it's like if you're just calculating the steady flow of electrons, that how many electrons cross through per second, you don't really have to worry about this aspect. But what you're now asking is, what's the noise? Okay? And then you have to bring in the particle aspect, and which then requires, yeah, usually the way it is done is with that second quantized formalism. Right? Landauer had a relatively physical way of describing it. Right? A relatively non-mathematical way.
Have
the physical description too, I think. Anyway, so, but otherwise, usually when you are looking at steady state problems, most of the time I'd say that electron is really behaving mostly like a wave. The particle aspect is not there in this discussion very much as it stands, right? So in that case, why is it that the semi-classical description works so well? What I mean by that is, you know, yesterday we talked about the semi-classical picture where you think of electrons as particles, essentially. Why is that working so well? Well, that's because of usually all interference effects just wash out, more or less, at room temperature especially. As I said, there could be interference effects, and some have actually been observed, you know, in the last 20 years. But by and large, they tend to wash out.
The Broglie effect also gets washed out if there are several levels.
there are many levels. Right. The other thing is the broadening. Right. So much of that usually, that is why usually the semi-classical picture were. And so whenever people say, well, you know, we'd like to set up an NEGF to do this problem, I always say, well, you know, that makes it a little harder because, as you know, instead of electron density, you have the matrix, etc. It gets a little harder. But is it really necessary? And often the motivation comes from, well, you know, I have the device, there's a part where I have a Schottky barrier where there's tunneling involved. And I don't quite know how to put it into Boltzmann. Okay, then maybe you could do NEGF for that part. Because NEGF for a big thing is relatively harder to do. So you always have to evaluate whether the NEGF is really...
So, can you explain again the two-step group? Because from the top board, I can only see that the current will saturate lower at lower current. So where is the second step comes from?
Why in that thing there are two steps in there? Yeah, this is where the cleanest way I know is. Yeah, though that would be a bit of a diversion. Diversion meaning I need to do some background discussion. And that is, when people discuss Coulomb blockade, usually in that limit, rather than use the one electron picture, they usually go to a two-electron picture or multi-electron picture. What that means is, they say that, okay, I have got this two levels in here. So instead of thinking of in terms of this one-electron thing, we'd say that this system can be in one of four states, which is what Dr. Raja wrote here. Those are the four states. So you could be in a state where it is 0-0, meaning both states are empty, or you could be in a state where it is 0-1, or you could be in a state where it's 1-0, or you could be in a state when both are occupied. And this has, say, energy 0. This has an energy epsilon. I think that's his that was the notation, epsilon d that he called. And this would be 2 epsilon d plus u. And then they say that, well, when an electron wants to, so the way current flows, of course, the basic thing is still the same. An electron has to come in and go out. So if it is in the 0-0 state, it's like an electron comes in, you go up to 0-1. If an electron comes in with that energy. And then it goes out again. And so what happens is the reason you get this current is when you have, the electrons have enough energy to be doing this. They do this. Now the second step comes in when the electrons even have enough energy to be doing that. To take you from 0-1 to 1-1, etc. So the point is, so when you actually start calculating currents, you use this picture. This is the full second quantized picture in a way, right? The way you're thinking now is not in terms of one electron trying to find a level and then getting out and all that, but more like the entire two system is, and this whole thing is one big system, which has happens to have four levels.
You can also think of it in terms of a discrete capacitor. Because one is trying to charge the capacitor, but the charging is happening only discretely. You cannot charge it continuously. So the charging is happening by putting in one electron. Then when you change the gate voltage by a certain finite amount, only then you can put in the second electron.
So yeah, so this would be the second quantized. So when you have very strong interactions then, that is when U is much greater than gamma, that is when we have a well-defined method for doing this. That you can solve it this way. And the only problem with this one is a practical one. Namely that, you see, you had two levels, so the number of states here was 4. If you happen to have n levels, the number of allowed states will be 2 to the power n. Why? Because, you see, every one of them can either be occupied or empty. And so, if you have 10 ones, then you can think of 2 to the power 10 states. Each one's 0 or 1. It's like a binary number, essentially, right? And so, it gets out of hand quickly. That's a practical problem. No conceptual issues at this end. On the other hand, when U is of the order of gamma or less, then you can use NEGF like we discussed. There's no particular problem there. The middle region is where it's not at all clear. Why? Well, what's wrong with this one? Why can't I use in the middle region? Well, because in this picture, it's hard to get this broadening into the picture. in this many body picture. You know, NEGF gives you a nice way of putting the broadening in the one particle picture. I have never seen a good way of putting a broadening into this picture in any reasonable way. And I've actually thought a lot about this. I've not quite seen anything there. And so there is no clean way of, that we know of. For special problems, people have found out special techniques, but there is no general way that takes you smoothly from here to there that I know of, that I've seen. No general way. And in a way, as you said, the high TC superconductor is kind of in between. You know, if there was a general way, of course, you would have solved that problem. In a way, you see? Because this is the band conduction limit, this is the Mott transition limit. And in between is, I guess, the Kondo effect is somewhere in between, actually. Kondo effect, the way, when you see those Kondo peaks that you see, which comes about, I mean, there's a level here, there's an extra peak here. That Kondo peak that you see is kind of when U is, you know, somewhere in this transition region. So it's the transition that's not very clear at all. Right? And it's not clear how to handle that. In general, it's an open question still, right? And people have special things for special problems, but not a general thing that I can throw up and say, okay, just go do this. That's not it. It's not that simple. Any questions related to this? Is this clear? Because this is important to know when you can use it and when you cannot. And so usually when people see Coulomb blockade at room temperature, it means that they have contacts that are very weakly coupled so that these gammas are really small. So electrons don't get in and out easily. So for example, in a MOS transistor, you would normally not get into that as far as source and drain is concerned. Because by definition, you are trying to make good contacts there. You are not going to put a bad contact in your source or drain. On the other hand, if you are having electrons jump into the gate, that part of it could be involved something in this regime. Because there it's, of course, a bad contact, really. And then getting in and out is kind of in the Coulomb blockade regime of it. Yeah. Okay. Is there anything you wanted to add? Any of this? Yes, please.
So, can you use any NEGF model for finding out if electrons can tunnel from one dot to another? We apply certain potential to one dot. So, let's say we have two dots which are closely spaced. We use a metal contact to apply certain electric field among the dots. So, can you use any NEGF to find out what would be the right voltage to move the dot, to move the electrons from one dot to another?
Offhand, I'm not seeing that you have a comment. Yes, please go ahead.
The problem of capacitively coupled quantum dots was solved very recently. So there are two or three papers on this by a person called David Logan, L-O-G-A-N. And he solved the problem of capacitively coupled quantum dots, which is exactly the problem that you mentioned. And it is actually equivalent to a multi-level single quantum dot. So it's like having one single quantum dot, but with two orbitals, for example, two levels which are available. It's actually equivalent to a capacitively coupled quantum dot. And in that problem has been solved in equilibrium exactly only very recently, 2009. And it's not been yet considered, I think, out of equilibrium.
Yeah, often I'd have said NEGF probably wouldn't add much to this. Because NEGF, the real power of it is like this connecting to the contacts, the leads, right? Transport, right. When transport is involved in connecting to the leads, the fact that it has the broadening automatically and correctly and all that, that's the real power of it under non-equilibrium conditions. And of course, it's non-equilibrium part of it, right? Because to me, it is the quantum version of Boltzmann equation. And even Boltzmann equation applies to dilute gases when you do not have very strong interactions. When you have strong interactions, even Boltzmann, you know, there are all these hierarchy of equations that people talk about with BBGKY hierarchy. And same here. So NEGF, in my mind, is kind of like the equivalent of Boltzmann. Right? So whenever this quantum dynamics is important, whether it's tunneling, interference, etc., but one particle picture is fine. Then I think it's relatively straightforward to use, then the answers are clear.
Kondo effect,
conceptually, what has been the challenge of proving the context and including the context? Incorporating broadening properly, or I mean, if I were to do it intuitively, how would I go wrong, for example? Or
In the one electron shot?
Yeah, if I take a physics course, quantum mechanics course, I cannot do this, right, immediately. I just let sure.
Yeah, usually you do not do the contact part,
right.
That's
so,
true.
And then if I were to think, what is I doing in 1 week, why couldn't I do it? I mean, I'm just hypothetically asking this question.
Yeah, somehow that contact problem, I always feel it's a very important one, but it's not, never quite been addressed much. And partly because contacts involve current flow, and historically, people always associate resistance with the sigma S, not with this elastic resistor that I'm talking about. And this is where I feel that in view of the developments in nanoelectronics, one should revise this point of view. And this should be kind of where all transport theory should start.
So in equilibrium, one can deal with it very easily. Out of equilibrium is hard. But in equilibrium, getting the broadening is very easy. Okay. So the way you can do it is, consider again a single level dot, right, which is coupled to a conduction band. So it's a broad conduction band, which is in contact with a lead, which is in contact with a single level. And you're modeling it using a certain hybridization parameter V.
That's how some band structure calculations.
It's a single particle picture, absolutely. Right? So you have one level epsilon d, and you have a v which takes you from d to c and c to d back. Right? So your Hamiltonian is basically like this: epsilon k, epsilon d, v and v. Okay? That's your Hamiltonian. You just diagonalize this, you get two branches.
Yeah.
Okay? So, and what you see there are actually the two branches.
Yeah, there's actually an example in your book about these two levels that they hybridize, right? So, but you see, non-equilibrium, it suddenly becomes much harder, and intuitively,
okay,
I would like
the problem is, yeah, so in the Landauer description, for example, the best thing about it is that the electron interactions are not taken into account, but the bias, you can put in as high as you want, right? The bias is taken completely non-perturbatively. And the problem is that if you want to include both, are you talking about electron-electron interactions or just out of equilibrium?
Just out of equilibrium.
Non-interacting, out of equilibrium, right? Yeah. So what you now have is this V, which is the hybridization, let me call it VH, and now you have a potential bias as well, right? Now adding these two both together seems to be making the problem difficult. And maybe the idea is that one, you see, in many problems what happens is, like in the Kondo effect, the Kondo scale, as I mentioned, goes as this. Right? So you cannot do a perturbation in the hybridization term. Right? If you do a perturbation about V equal to 0, you will not get a series. There is no Taylor expansion because it's, you can see it's an essential similarity. Right? So the point is that the problem that we are trying to do is very similar to this, because we are trying to do, let's say you want to do a perturbation about this contact, about the hybridization, then you would not get a Taylor series. You would not be able to stop anywhere. In fact, there is no Taylor series for the hybridization. And I presume the bias is also very strongly influenced in that. So that is probably what is happening. But in equilibrium, broadening can be calculated very easily.
Top one is this equilibrium green function. So, and if you read a standard many body theory like, say, Fetter and Walachka, it will be all about the equilibrium green function. It will be all about that, right? That's what it is. Whereas the second, that equation is, as I said, that's the thing that first appeared in Keldysh's 1965 paper. And is not as widely known or as widely used, actually. And I'd say it is in the device context that it's used a lot more. Because usually in our problems, we are always dealing with non-equilibrium things. Okay? Most of the stuff. And the standard approach often that was adopted there for quantum transfer was this Kubo formalism, which kind of doesn't quite tackle the non-equilibrium problem. Instead, it maps it into an equilibrium problem. In other words, it says that the fluctuation dissipation theorem, linear response. So it says that the DI DV is proportional to the equilibrium noise, and then you can use equilibrium statmec to calculate the noise, right? So yeah. But the thing is, it only gives you linear response right around equilibrium. And this is where I have felt that a lot of the interesting things in future probably will be far from equilibrium things. You know, especially if you think of future directions as involving, say, connections to biology, which in my mind is a far from equilibrium problem, all kinds of things. So I'd say one really needs good ways of handling far from equilibrium problems.
In fact, the nanoscale problems are inherently out of equilibrium, right? I mean, you cannot treat the problems in equilibrium, but it is a non-equilibrium problem, right?
I guess you could measure specific heat and things like that. Non-equilibrium. You're thinking it won't be measurable?
Yeah, the static itself would break down, right? Because static has been built around the thermodynamic level. So the fluctuations are assumed wherever you do a canonical ensemble or partition function analysis, there the n is assumed to go to infinity. Otherwise, you would get fluctuations which are order of 1 by root n. You wouldn't get extensive quantities with them. The entropy would not be extensive.
Yeah, what I'm wondering is whether with a time average you can get around it? You don't have the ensemble average.
The hypothesis does not hold.
So would
the
not.
Hypothesis are not equal to the ensemble averages. So that the whole ergodic hypothesis is...
if you look at the resistance of this something very small,
yeah.
You're saying the fluctuations will be very large. Even after... So the thing that I think that kind of came into mesoscopic physics in the late 80s, was that prior to that, everyone always calculated ensemble averages. And then they said, well, now we should calculate sample-specific things. Right? And so, as I mentioned before, on a single, if you measure conductance versus Vg in some of these FETs at low temperatures, it's supposed to go up, but then there is all these fluctuations, which are all sample-specific. For a particular sample, you'd get this. If you move it around, you'll get something else. Right? So, and these can be calculated. Of course, the idea is that if you knew exactly how the impurities were distributed, you'd probably be able to. But then you don't quite know. So what you can put in is some random thing and you'll see something of the right size. And then what was one of the interesting things that was proved there was the size of these fluctuations would be this of the order of Q square over H, etc. Right?
This harmonic limit, n, what is the order of n you call infinity? Like one above or not?
Yeah, there is usually the Avogadro number and the usual standard. But then as you go down to nano systems, what you should be considering is the 1 by root n, right? That's what the fluctuation occurs. And that should be compared to the average value. So there is that crossover regime is specific to different systems, but I would guess of the order of 100 to 1000 atoms, below that you would start getting strong non
equilibrium. Because most of the nano scale, now people are trying too much nano, but one dimension is one time, but the other two dimensions is pretty large. If you take a thin film transistor, you have two dimensions which is micrometer long, and you have a lot of atom to validate center limit theorem. So in that case, I think it's equilibrium.
Yeah, 2D systems, even 1D systems which are large,
yeah,
they are
one direction like
nano. You can do equilibrium transistors. Only when the ergodic hypothesis breaks down, you start looking at strongly non-equilibrium. Because in using ergodic hypothesis, one can equate the time average and the ensemble average. And that makes up.
So, in this example, you'd say this one is an ensemble average, which is what you'd get if you took lots of samples and averaged it, while this is a time average thing, of course. I mean, because you are sitting there measuring it over time anyway, and this is what you're actually measuring, the time average thing. But if you took hundreds of these samples and averaged the answer, you'd probably have got that one. And any ensemble average would get you that. That's the point you're making. Got it.
I mean, there are violations of fluctuation dissipation theorem, which basically come from the fact that the fluctuations are not described by the dissipation.
Yes. Right. So I guess a very good question is here, whether this is a fluctuation or not. Okay. What I mean by that is fluctuations are not supposed to be reproducible. What I said there was a very important point was this is something that you could go down every day and measure exactly this. That is what made this a very important observation then. That you could go back the next day and you still measure exactly the same thing. Okay. Yeah. Any other questions related to this? Yes, please. I didn't hear you very well. Yeah, please speak up.
So now we have relative movement of the atom chain. So how can we define the velocity of photon?
How can we define the
velocity of the photon?
Velocity of a photon. How would you define? Oh,
I think it's a collective vibration of all atoms. So how can you define the velocity?
Oh. Yeah, so usually people calculate this omega versus k, right, of phonons in a given solid, right? And if you look down here, the slope is this sound velocity. If you look this at this slope, right? And that's what you usually, is the sound that you are used to, like in a solid, right? That would be a sound. And here, of course, the wavelengths involved are very long. And then when you go up this all day, now, so velocity is the slope of this. Now so what moves is that vibration, I suppose. So just like sound, if you tap it at one end, something propagates. So question is, at what speed does that propagate? And that's supposed to be this d omega dk. So for example, there is this thing called optical phonons, which usually hardly move. And the reason is that it is just a localized vibration usually. So, let's say in gallium arsenide, is this gallium and arsenic just moving there? And the next unit cell doesn't necessarily even know about it. So you could do something at this end, nothing will propagate. Right? And that's basically why it's almost flat. Okay? But the velocity would be, yeah, this slope. And when you come here, it doesn't move quite so fast. That's how you think. And with the EK relations also with electrons, as I mentioned, the general definition of velocity is this dE dp. It is basically d omega dk, you know, same idea, of course.
And related to the problem of describing delocalized object. So what you are saying is there is a delocalized object. Now, how do you describe the propagation of this delocalized object, right? I mean, it's not a local object. Oh. It was a particle. Then you could really measure the distance and the time it covers, and then you find the velocity. But if you have a delocalized object, which is like a collective acceleration composed of many particles, right? Now, what I would say is, suppose you consider a free electron, right? A free electron, you solve the Schrodinger equation. What do you get? You get a plane wave solution, right? Now, plane wave solution, can you really tell where it is?
No.
You cannot, right? But you can define a velocity.
Yeah, that is what they define in terms of the group velocity, right? So that is the argument you go through that, yeah, if you had, like you said, you know, if there's a plane wave here, the wave function, of course, is e to the power ikx. And that's everywhere. So if it's everywhere, you can't tell what its velocity is. So you kind of have to define a wave packet one place in X and, you know, look at it at 9 o'clock and then look at it at 10 o'clock again and see how far it got. Right? That's right. And now the question point is that if at 9 o'clock you want to localize it here, you have to take a whole bunch of Ks and put them together. So according to some K, you put a whole bunch of them together. That's how you localize it. And one of the exercises they go through is that an approximate description of how fast it gets is given by this group velocity, which is d omega dk. So in the wave picture, that's why they say the group velocity is d omega dk. Whereas in the particle picture, this definition of velocity, that came from Hamilton's equation of motion. When the way Hamilton wrote his equations, it was this dx dt is supposed to go as dE dp, and then dp dt is supposed to go as dE dx. So, when you think of it as particles, that's the Hamilton's equations of motion. Whereas, when you think of it as waves, this one is basically identified with group velocity. While this one is like Newton's law. You know, it says that the rate of change of momentum is equal to the force. That's it. And this is where yesterday I made the point that, you know, it is dp dt that's equal to the force, not m dv dt. It's what, because depending on if you're trying to use non-standard EP relationships, then you have to be careful which one you use, etc. But these are the general equations that would work regardless of the energy-momentum relationship. One question I think someone asking me is whether that if you have an electric field in some region, so that let's say we draw the potential as sloping down, so this is X, and the potential is sloping down, that's since there's an electric field, then the P keeps increasing, and question was whether the way I was describing the elastic resistor, that the electron is going through with a fixed energy, does that include this fact that the K is, that the momentum is increasing? And the point is actually does, because the way you think about it here is that you have some EK relation here, and down here it's like the same thing kind of went down. So if you are at fixed energy, you just end up with a bigger P. That's it. You see, so the fact that the P increases, that's equivalent to saying the energy stays the same and the potential energy went down. Because total energy is constant, the kinetic energy. So that's kind of part of the same story. I don't really need to include that separately. This I just remember because someone had asked me whether this was included or not. And so this statement that dp dt equals du dx can be proved just from this idea that the total energy stays constant. Okay. I think there was one question regarding the thermoelectric effect. I don't know if the... I guess we have a few minutes, so if there is anything else then related to the second talk on the thermal, because we more or less focused on the quantum transport part, and of course there were lots of issues to clear up, so I think it's good. And yeah, someone I think sent a note, and this I was not aware of this, that actually there are metals which have different Seebeck coefficients. You know, the point I had made was that if you have a mu here and the density of states is up here, then you would have one kind of Seebeck coefficient. On the other hand, if you had a density of states here, like this, you'd have a different Seebeck coefficient because of the point what we had discussed. And that, I said, kind of explains, and it all comes from this F1 minus F2. The fact that a hot thing looks like this, a cold thing looks like this, and here, F1 minus F2 drives electrons this way. Here, F1 minus F2 drives electrons the other way. And that's why there's this difference. And I guess the question was, then how is it that there are metals which have different signs for this Seebeck coefficient? Because all metals, of course, this is a P-type semiconductor. But there are metals which are, metals usually would be like a conduction band, I suppose. So usually it will be in the middle of a density of state somewhere. And this I've not thought about, but my first guess would be that there is a decreasing density of states locally at that energy probably. So what I mean by that is the sign of the Seebeck coefficient all depends on, if you draw the mu, whether you have more states above or below. That's the issue really. And if locally around there happens to be an opposite slope, it could change the sign. That I see. But this is something I haven't looked into, so I'm not sure.
So my experience in this has been that if you look at resistivity, then it does not really depend that much on the detailed K-dependent band structure. But if you look at the thermoelectric power or the thermoelectric effect or the Hall coefficient, most of the ensemble coefficients basically, the L12, L11 and so on. L11 is very simple, doesn't depend on the detailed band structure. But if you look at all the others, then they depend on the detailed band structure. And the full Brillouin zone, how the K dependence is for EK, the E versus K vector, that actually comes into the picture. Because you find out something from this transport estimation, and that really matters.
Yeah, though with thermopower, I'd say that, you know, that is usually the standard expression for evaluating that coefficient. You know, the one on the right. And one on the left is for evaluating conductance. That's the L11. The second coefficient is like the L12, which involves this E minus mu. And so To me, I think the important thing is whether what it is above mu compared to what it is below mu. So basically, it's a question of whether these energies conduct better or these energies conduct better. And that's what determines, as far as thermopower goes. Hall effect, I feel, is really involves band structure. I mean, that EK relationship and all, and that is why I feel that in amorphous materials, Hall effect is so poorly understood. While thermopower is relatively well understood.
You're saying where the fermi level is, whether it divides it into the unoccupied part is more of the occupied part.
Which part conducts better? Right. Because above it, electrons will be driven in one direction. Below it, they'll be driven in another direction. And the balance is determined by which side conducts better. That to me is the essence of all the thermoelectric effects. And probably one other point that I said that if you have a energy level here that an electron is conducting through, and this is mu 1, this is mu 2, then effectively the electron takes that much energy from this contact and dumps it into that contact. So this actually gets cooled in the sense you take energy from the contact, right? And I said that was kind of the origin of this Peltier effect in a way. And here, of course, I assumed that this contact has no special structure in the density of states, so that when a current flows, it flows symmetrically right around here. That's the assumption here. But of course, in any real material, it is always biased a little bit one way or the other. So the current here could be flowing a little higher up. And the entire Peltier effect is because you have one material where it flows, say, a little, say, 1 millivolt higher, and somewhere else where it moves, say, 10 millivolts higher. And then in order to adjust, that region must either cool or heat, according to whether it went up or down, etc. So Peltier effect, in that sense, what you measure is kind of the difference between what you have on the left and what you have on the right. And for our discussion, I assume the contact was a simple thing with zero Seebeck coefficient or zero Peltier coefficient. So you got just that.